Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Greetings. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, and CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. It's our regular Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives, the longest-serving independent member in the history of the House of Representatives, and now running as an independent for the United States Senate. His website, Bernie.org. I think of Bernie Sanders as America's congressman, and I hope to, in a year, be able to call him America's senator. Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you here, Bernie. Bernie, what's on your agenda for the day here?
Well, there are a lot of issues. Let me begin by wishing all of the listeners a very happy holiday season and a healthy new year. There's a lot that's going on. Let me just, if I might, touch a little bit on what the president is saying about the economy. Clearly, one of their spins right now is the economy is vibrant. We're creating all kinds of new jobs. Things are just great. But the reality, Tom, as I think most of the listeners know, is that there's a lot in that that's simply not true. While economic growth is in fact strong, and we're delighted by that, why new jobs are being created, why more tax revenue is going into the states, all of which are good things, the reality is that for the average American worker, what we are continuing to see is a decline in real wages. This is almost like the operation being a success, but the patient dying. In the abstract, the economy is doing well, but for ordinary people, the middle class continues to shrink, poverty continues to increase. More and more Americans are continuing to lose their health insurance pensions under tremendous threat. And in truth, as I think most people now understand, the economy is doing phenomenally well for the CEOs of large corporations, while the middle class is struggling and more people become poor. So what you're in the midst of is the famous Karl Rove spin season. But I think most Americans know the truth that this economy really is not working well for ordinary people. Second issue that I think people have been seeing in the front pages of some papers today is increased attacks on our constitutional rights and civil liberties on the part of the Bush administration. We now learn that the government has been tapping and eavesdropping on, we don't know, hundreds, maybe thousands of Americans in a way that is illegal from my perspective. And this ties in with other information that we're getting, is that huge amounts of American taxpayer dollars are now being spent implanting stories, not only in Iraq and the Middle East, but all over the world. So that without the newspapers knowing this, or the readers knowing at least, this comes from the United States government. So you take a deep breath and you say, wow, these guys talk about freedom, freedom, and freedom, and yet what they're trying to do is undermine constitutional rights, undermine the rights of people throughout the world to get the truth of what's happening by paying newspapers, planting stories, paying reporters to put the spin of the U.S. government out there. And, wow, you know, that's bad stuff.
And meanwhile, George W. Bush is saying that the NSA and the FBI should be able to spy on average Americans.
Right. And then on top of that, the takeover of public television in this country by, you know, right-wing political hacks for the first time, really bringing politics into that, suggests that despite all of their rhetoric about freedom, what they really believe is that the government should have huge influence in distorting reality and controlling the lives of ordinary people. And it's a very, very dangerous situation.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And on a somewhat related issue here, Congressman, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. We're talking to Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website. The Detroit News is reporting today on a story in the Miami Herald. I know you're a supporter of Rush Holt's bill to try to ensure integrity of voting machines.
Yes.
Well, they did a test, and this was conducted with the cooperation of Leon County, Florida election supervisor Ian Sancho on the Diebold machines that scan, the optical scan machines, the ones like in Vermont where you fill in the little circle, you know, with a pen, and then you feed it through the machine. And I'll read you a couple of sentences here from the Detroit News story. Tests of an optical scan voting system used around the country showed it is vulnerable to hacking and can change the outcome of races without leaving evidence of fraud, a county election supervisor said. In one of the tests conducted for Sancho, this is Ian Sancho, the county supervisor, election supervisor, and the nonprofit election monitoring group blackboxvoting.org, the researchers were able to get into the system easily, make the loser the winner, and leave without a trace.
Needless to say, frightening. Tom, hold on for one second. I've got to run and vote, and I will be...
Oh, yeah, you're on the floor.
Yeah, in 10 seconds. Hold on.
Okay. All righty. Great. While Bernie's gone, I'll finish sharing the story with our listeners. It's because I already know his take. Sancho, now in another test, the researchers who had hacked into the voting machine's memory card was able to hide votes, make losers out of winners, and leave with no trace of the changes. Sancho, the election supervisor, is
literally on the floor of the House here.
So you just voted. So now the election supervisor is criticizing the Secretary of State of Florida for certifying these machines. And a spokeswoman for the Secretary of State's office says any faults Sancho finds is between him and Diebold. And but the Miami Times reports that Leon County is no longer using the machines.
I congratulate the county and the leadership there for calling attention to this huge issue. I hope that other commissioners around the country and secretaries of state learn from that. This guy did the right thing.
Yeah.
And I hope this is a lesson that is learned in 50 states in America. As I have said many times, I hope that people don't become paranoid about the issue. But what this test suggests is that you have a technology, obviously, that can be manipulated effectively, and we've got to deal with that.
Yeah.
I often make the point, Tom, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think that in Canada, they still use paper ballots. Is that right?
Yeah. In fact, in Quebec, they tried our voting machines 3 years ago, and then they gave them back.
And why? We live right near the Canadian border. We follow Canadian politics a little bit. I know on election night, they have all of the results coming in a few hours after the votes are cast. No one ever disputes them. It's quick. It's honest.
That's the same as true all over Europe.
So I think we got to do some rethinking about how we're counting votes in this country.
What's also really interesting is another one of the big voting machine companies, Sequoia Systems, has been bought out by a Venezuelan outfit, by three Venezuelan men.
Mm-hmm.
And Hugo Chavez, who has a lot of conservative opponents in the United States, deployed these Sequoia machines in Venezuela. And so the conservatives now in Venezuela are saying that the vote was rigged by Chavez because it was done on these electronic machines. It's so strange. It's like you're living in parallel universes, But I know that you have been supporting Rush Holt and trying to clean this thing up.
Absolutely. On one hand, I don't want, I hope people don't become paranoid and think every vote in America is being manipulated. On the other hand, there's no question that I think what this study in Florida shows is a potentially dangerous technology, and we have to address that issue. And to my mind, it's not like we're up against the wall, and this is the only thing that is available to us to count votes, right?
Yeah, for sure. And for that matter, it may be possible to like government buys paper clips, government buys typewriters, government buys computers. I have no problem with governments, frankly, buying voting machines if the software was open source and we the people owned the software.
No, I share that.
How it was being done. But in any case, we're a little off topic. You started out by talking about how the president says the economy is going so great. I read an article, and I'm trying to recall where it was. It was earlier this week. I think it was in the Wall Street Journal. It said that perhaps a majority of the jobs that have been created in the last year or so have been in the government sector, not the private sector.
Well, that's one of the areas, certainly. I don't have the statistic in front of me, but it is no secret that over the last many years, there has been a significant increase in government jobs. But most importantly, when we look at jobs, a job is a job. We want job creation, period. But we also want to make sure that the jobs that are being created pay people a living wage and have decent benefits. And increasingly what we are seeing in America is the loss of good-paying jobs with good benefits and the creation of low-paying jobs, Walmart-type jobs, with minimal benefits. And we are looking at a situation, if we do not change it, when for the first time in modern American history, our kids may very well have a lower standard of living than we have. And obviously that is not the kind of economy that we want to see.
We have an obligation to be doing something about this. Do you think that the new Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, is going to be significantly different from your old nemesis, Alan Greenspan?
Hard to say. Don't know the answer to that.
Okay. We will be taking your calls for Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM. Our toll-free telephone number all across the United States. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. This is our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman radio program. You can also drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Working together like spokes inside a wheel, they keep this country turning around. Hello, Kansas, sweet Bill Farmer, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just to sing it all down.
Indeed, it's the working people of this country that built this country. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where despair is not an option. Get active. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us 21 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. And Tony in San Diego, California, you are live with Congressman Bernie Sanders, I believe. Yep. Let me see. Yeah, Hey, Bernie, I think it's going to... Yeah. Yeah, Tony, you on there? He's not coming through the board. Okay, we're going to try Eric here. Let's try Eric in Houston, Texas. Now, we got this board set up wrong somehow. I'm sorry. Bernie, you... Okay, we got John in Coopersville, Michigan. John, you're live and on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, John.
I'm doing fine. I'm glad for the service you provide on the radio.
Thank you.
And I was watching on C-SPAN the debate over in the House over the H.R. 4437, and you were talking about middle-class wages. And I'd like to know Bernie's position on this matter before the House. That, you know, it seems like the tables are turned. The Republicans are supporting the ban on the illegal aliens coming across their borders, and the Democrats are supporting that issue. What's your position on this, Bernie?
Well, the issue on immigration, I'll tell you what my position on immigration is. Number one, illegal immigration is illegal. We have not been doing a particularly good job in stopping that, and I think we have got to. On the other hand, if you have somebody here in this country who has kids, who has been here for 10 years, who pays taxes, is a law-abiding citizen, I don't think you can pick that person up or their kids up and throw them out of the country. And that's the context I think that we have got to approach immigration.
The terrible dilemma here, Bernie, is so many of these people have been here, and we've got a lot of people who are short-termers, and
right.
if we shipped them out tomorrow morning, it would decrease the supply of labor, increase the demand for labor, increase
right.
wages in the United States. It might be a good thing. But there are also people who have been here for
right.
20, 30 years.
That's
they
right.
have children who are U.S. citizens.
That's my point.
I mean, how do we deal with that?
Well, it ain't easy. It ain't easy. But that's, I mean, I'm not sympathetic to those people who say anyone who's here illegal, no matter if they've been here 20 or 30 years, raise kids, throw them out tomorrow. I don't think you can do that. On the other hand, the fact that so many people are coming into this country illegally is a very serious problem. I'll tell you, one of the real problems is that a lot of employers who benefit from this cheap labor are prepared definitely to look the other way and do not want to see us crack down on illegal immigration. You have significant parts of the economy, California, Texas, and elsewhere, that are being run on through the efforts of illegal immigrants. It depresses wages. It is not fair to the workers of this country. So that is the context in which we have got to come up with a solution.
Yeah, well said. It's 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And now I have lost my cursor. There, boy, we are having, Bill in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program. Bill? We have lost Bill. Bernie, I'm sorry, we're having a funky phone situation here. It is a strange phone day. So let's just take a pause from the phone calls for a moment.
Okay.
And can you, and we can resolve this over the break at the bottom of the hour. I'm wondering, Bernie, what do you see as the biggest issues coming up before Congress when Congress comes back after the holidays?
Well, I think Iraq is certainly going to be a major issue. And the question there is the following. I think all Americans, regardless of their political views, I voted, of course, against giving the president authority to go to war and was one of the leaders of that effort. I think history will indicate that was the right vote. But I think all of us want to see the Iraqi people do as well as they can under very difficult circumstances. My own view on that, the way I think Congress should move, is to start bringing home our troops as quickly as possible. And by that, I happen to think, Tom, that we can withdraw a majority of our troops probably within the next 6 months after the election, which is taking place now. And I think we can probably get almost all of them out within a year, leaving a contingency in Kuwait with some nearby country for emergencies.
You know, Barney, isn't the irony of it that if we did that, it would be the very best thing that could happen for the Republicans? For the election of 2006?
Well, I as I have indicated many times publicly, I think the president is going to start with withdrawing troops. So that's why it's important for those of us who are not Republicans to make it clear that that is our position. I think what the president will do is, no matter what the case is in Iraq, declare victory and start bringing the troops home.
Yeah, because if not, the Republicans are going to be sunk in 2006. And I think, you know, all of us want the troops to come home as quickly as possible. And I just find it ironic. It doesn't mean that, you know, we shouldn't, you know, get our troops out of harm's way, because they're there with bullseyes on their backs right now.
Right.
A terrible situation. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. I believe we have our telephones fixed. Our telephone number, 866, toll free, 866-440-8466. Toll-free, 866-440-THOM, all across the United States. 27 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, Brunch with Bernie. Bernie.org is Bernie's website.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line. A flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze. One leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore.
Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, coming up on 25 minutes before the hour, is the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. And Bernie, looks like cloture failed in the Senate.
That, Tom, is very good news. It's very good news for those of us who believe in constitutional rights, who know that we can protect the American people against terrorist attacks, fight terrorism aggressively, but do it in a way that does not undermine the Constitution of the United States of America. So if that's true, I want to congratulate Senator Feingold, Senator Sununu, and all of the others, both progressive Democrats, conservative Republicans, who have come together to say to President Bush, sorry, you're not going to abrogate constitutional rights in this country.
Yeah, great. Thank you very whoops, just got a...
And Tom, I should say, yeah, very interesting coalition. We had it here in the House of Representatives. I work as one of the more progressive members of the Congress with some of the more conservative members, and we're seeing that coalition coming together in the Senate as well. So it's a good start. A lot more work has got to go on. The American people have got to become engaged in that issue. We do not want the FBI or the government agencies running rampant into our personalized, our reading records, our medical records, our financial transactions without an independent judiciary saying, well, that's okay, these guys are involved in terrorist activity.
Let's just very quickly, Bernie, I said, you know, cloture failed, and you were talking about the meaning of it or the significance of it, but I think many of our listeners may not know what I meant.
what we're talking about. In the Senate, the minority, people obviously can talk for as long as they want, and to override that, you need 60 votes. To stop the discussion. And if you can keep it going, that gives a lot of strength in the minority position, because then the majority is going to have to sit down and work with them if they want to get on to other business.
Yeah, and this keeping on talking is also known as filibuster.
Filibuster, right.
Right. So, in other words, the Republicans don't have enough votes to stop a Democratic filibuster of the Patriot Act.
Yes.
And as it stands. And so they're going to have to sit down and negotiate with the Democrats, and hopefully this 90-day short-term bill will... Is that a solution?
No, it's not a solution. But at least it gives us time to negotiate something. I should say that one of the, and there are a number of provisions there. I passed an amendment on the floor of the House with virtually all Democrats and a number of Republicans, took out of Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act libraries and bookstores, so that the FBI just could not go into a library and a bookstore and get people's reading records without having to justify to an independent judge as to why they thought that person deserved to be investigated. That is one of the lingering positions out there which the Senate is deeply concerned about, and I share that concern. So what we saw today is a victory for those of us who are concerned about constitutional rights. A lot more work has got to be done. Believe me, this fight is not over, but it's a good development.
Yeah, you don't just share that concern. I mean, you were one of the first to really raise that issue.
We introduced the First Amendment that would make changes in the USA Patriot Act.
We being Bernie Sanders.
Me and my staff.
There you go. Let's go to the telephone lines, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And John in Scranton, Pennsylvania, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Hey, John.
Hi, guys. Always a pleasure. Love this segment. Congressman, I have two questions. The first one's a quick question. Being an independent, how do you manage to be successful in getting reelected in a world that's controlled by big money? I mean, how do you do that? That's the first one. The second one has to do with the books that came out a few years ago by Richard Clark and Bob Woodward and the one about Paul O'Neill that were all very, very consistent in painting a not-so-pretty picture of what happened in the run-up to the war.
Right.
And basically, that one is the awareness of congressmen and people about those books. And, you know, they can't all be lying. I mean, and that one is mainly, is that any real basis for looking into this further?
In terms of your first question, I get reelected in Vermont and have been elected 8 times. I believe because I do a good job. I try to stand up for working families, the middle class, lower income people. I'm prepared to take on big money interests.
Let me toss in here, Bernie, if I may, because I lived in Vermont for 10 years, and that you are, not only you get consistent reelected, but some of the strongest support for you is in areas that are, you know, rural and described by many as conservative.
Well, you know, as we've discussed, the word conservative is a big word. And I think that you find a lot of rural conservatives, especially, they are working people. They can't afford health insurance. They want to send their kids to college. They're worried about the environment. They don't want to see their jobs go to China. They don't want to see the gap between the rich and the poor grow wider and wider. And, yeah, we speak to those issues. And I am very proud to say we win a lot of that support. We stand up, for example, on the issue of veterans' rights. You know, I don't want to get into a long discussion about it right now, but the Bush administration's a record in terms of undermining the needs of our veterans is just an outrage. So we do talk about those issues, and we're very proud to get conservative support. On the second question that John called about, what Richard Clark was saying and what others have said is that before 9/11, there was an understanding in the White House that the president was interested in going to war and overthrowing Saddam Hussein from the very beginning. We had Paul O'Neill indicating that he was shocked. One of the first, he was Secretary of the Treasury. He walks into a cabinet meeting, and lo and behold, he's finding out that at the very first meetings, we have high-ranking people, the president and others, talking about the need to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And all of that, Tom, speaks to something that is enormously important. And that is my hope that if the Democrats gain control of either the House or the Senate, that one of the very first take responsibility for the faulty intelligence that I got from the CIA and other intelligence agencies. You know what? That ain't true. The president may have gotten faulty intelligence, but he also got good intelligence. Mm-hmm. On issue after issue, the president and his administration received information that said, no, we don't think Saddam Hussein is involved with Osama bin Laden. No, we don't think that Iraq is developing uranium, is getting uranium from Niger. No, we don't think that Saddam Hussein is building weapons of mass destruction, and the guy that you have who is telling you all that stuff is not reliable. No, we don't think those, you remember those tubes, those aluminum tubes?
Yeah.
No, we don't think that their primary purpose is for a nuclear program. The president had all of that intelligence. He chose to use what he wanted to, and it's not fair to be dumping on the intelligence agencies.
Yeah, and Dan, apparently they didn't share all of that intelligence, that counterintelligence, with Congress.
That is correct.
Yeah. Dave in Albany, Oregon, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, how you doing? Bernie, it's always good to hear from you on Friday.
Good to be with you.
Can you keep doing that when you're a senator?
I sure will. If Tom will have me, I'll be there.
Oh, you betcha.
Why can't they base the minimum wage on COLI, the cost of living index?
Well,
a formula that's self-adjusting every year or two.
Well, because McDonald's and Walmart's and all these other companies don't think it's a good idea. And unfortunately, with the Republican leadership here, those are the folks that are listened to. Clearly, one of the moral outrages, forget about economics, the moral outrages that we are looking at right now is that you have a president and a congressional leadership that has fought tooth and nail successfully to provide hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%, and yet there has been zero discussion about raising the minimum wage, which today is at a shamefully low $5.15 an hour. So to answer Dave's question is, the needs of low-income workers are not a concern of the Republican leadership here. They're working tooth and nail for the wealthy and the powerful, and that is a very sad state of affairs.
Our number, 866-440-8466, Alice in Eureka, California. Is that our 91-year-old Alice, a regular caller?
Yeah.
Hey, Alice. Hello, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Okay. Somehow, some way, one of the bills to make voting machines verifiable needs to get to the floor for a vote. Clearly, they plan to rig the election again next year.
Well, Alice, we hope, Tom mentioned earlier that there is a bill being proposed by Congressman Rush Holt of New Jersey. I am strongly supportive of that. Many of us are. Whether the Republican leadership will allow it to come to the floor, can't tell you, probably not, but it is something that we want to see happen. But we also want to see happen at the state level. You know, states control elections, not the federal government. And state governments can begin to do what we discussed earlier in this program in Florida, is making sure that the voting machines that are being used in every state in this country are accurate, that there's a paper trail. And that is also something we should be focusing attention on.
Okay. We have about 30 seconds before we got to take a break. Mark in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Bernie?
Yes, Mark.
I just wanted to mention that it's so frustrating for us to see the lack of fairness on the in the media, particularly NBC and CBS. For example, the other night, NBC had the hearing by the governor of Louisiana with this commission, all Republicans, where they were just pushing the blame on her for the catastrophe of Katrina.
Mark, I'm going to have to ask you. Mark, I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll let you finish your sentence on the way back, and then Bernie can respond.
Okay.
I know he has some serious thoughts about the media in the United States.
Right.
45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment, Bernie.org, the website.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We live in the land of plenty, but many things aren't plenty anymore. Like the water from our sink,
they say it's not safe to drink. You gotta go and buy it at the store. Now we're told there's a hole in the ozone. Look what's washing on the beach. And Lord, I believe from the heavens to the sea, we're bringing Mother Nature to her knees.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, we need to do something about it. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives running for the United States Senate. His website, bernie.org. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. And Bernie, just before the break, we had Mark from Pittsburgh on, and he was raising the issue of the way the media has been handling a lot of these issues.
And he raises a good issue, and we should never forget, and I'm afraid many people just don't know it, that these big media networks like NBC that Mark referred to, in that case, they're owned by General Electric, CBS is owned by Verizon.
Viacom.
Viacom, I'm sorry. I knew it was a V. There it was. ABC by Disney, and you got Fox out there, and so forth and so on. My concern, Tom, is not just the right-wing tilt of the media, which is what Mark was referring to, but it's the major, major stories that nobody ever talks about. The fact that the middle class is collapsing in America today, poverty is increasing, and the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider, those are facts that nobody disagrees with. How often do you hear that story being told in whatever context? On television. The fact that we're the only nation in the industrialized world that does not have a national health care program, and that we spend twice as much per person on health care as any other nation. How often is that story told? The fact that our people are working the longest hours of any major country on earth and seeing their incomes declining in real wages. How often do we talk about that? So what happens is the most important issues that impact the real lives of real people is not talked about, and then we're shocked to learn that people don't really pay attention to politics. They're more worried about the Survivors program or some other program on TV than in fact, what really happens.
Yeah.
So that's to me, the main problem with TV.
Well said. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. I think. Alec, I'm going to have to ask you to put Dennis on because I just lost my screen. Oh, there we go. Dennis, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, gentlemen, and Senator Bernie, claim that victory.
Now we've got a long way to go, Dennis.
But I claimed it for you already.
All right.
This is my whole thing, and I was a little pessimistic, and I'm still very pessimistic, and you kind of touched upon it, the fact that nobody's paying attention to these other problems that I think are huge. I even think they're greater than the Iraq problem, and I think that Bush is going to have some success there. We might as well be resigned to that, and once he does that, I think, what are we going to do to get the government, get the people back in line? And you just hit it on there. You kind of stole my thunder a little bit because they've got the media locked up, and nobody seems to be paying attention to the plight of the middle class, the fact that we're going in debt above our eyeballs, and, I don't see any end to it. I don't see us taking the Senate. I don't see us taking the House back.
No. All right. Dennis, don't get too pessimistic. Because, pessimism is
that's just what they want. They want us to give up and go away.
Now, look, if you're them, you should not be all of that happy. I mean, the president's poll numbers, while going up a little bit, are very, very low. On race after race around this country, we're finding Republican senators are trailing. The Republican Party, let me tell you, I'm right here on the floor of the House, they're not a bunch of happy campers now. They are very, very worried. And what we have got to do is just be aggressive. We've got to be involved 365 days a year. As Dennis indicates, we have got to pound away at the issues that the American people feel in their guts. And what they feel in their guts is that there's something wrong when 46 million Americans have no health insurance, when the cost of health care is soaring, when people are losing decent-paying jobs, going to China, going to Mexico, when the gap between the wealthy and the poor is growing wider and wider. We have CEOs in America making 400 times what workers make. Who thinks that that is moral and that is right? And then on top of that, we have the Republican leadership wanting to cut back on college education loans, food stamps for low-income people, Medicaid to make a bad situation even worse. They got nothing. They got very few issues that they can really talk about. And I think we don't have the luxury of being pessimistic or cynical. We've just got to go out and talk to our neighbors. educate and organize. And if we do that, I think we're going to have a very good election day.
Well said. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. We have about a minute and a half left, I think.
Bernie, this current Republican control here, we've seen this movie before. This crowd brought us the Republican Great Depression. Their mission is to dismantle the New Deal. It always has been. They've always talked about it. Why don't we remind America about their history? We don't have to go far. 60 years ago, they did this.
Right.
And we had to correct it.
Well, Tom, some of us try to do that. As we indicated earlier, not everything that some of us say gets onto NBC or CBS. But you're absolutely right. These guys, those who went before them, opposed Social Security. They fought almost every piece of legislation that benefited the middle class and working people and lower-income people. Their outrageous attacks and dishonest attacks in their effort to privatize Social Security really tells you where they're coming from, much more sympathetic to Wall Street than the needs of retirees.
Well,
They're
right up front about it, Bernie. Here's Rush Limbaugh.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
I mean, they just say it. It's amazing. It's amazing. We got to wake up Americans. You're doing such a great job of it. Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie.org, the website. And be sure to check it out. Congressman Bernie Sanders, thanks so much for being with us for our Brunch with Bernie segment here.
Good to be with you, Tom. Take care.
Always great talking with you, Bernie.
Bye-bye.
It is 56 minutes past the hour, coming up on a minute and a half before the hour here. The Tom Hartman radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Are you losing your hair? Fight back with Avacor, now with Boost, which gives you visibly thicker hair with the first application.
I'm 20 years old and I've been losing my hair for 3 years. I started using Avacor and my hair stopped falling out. It's working.
Well, I'm 72 years old, and I can tell you honestly, I have a...
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on White Rose Society, radiopower.org, airamericaradio.com, crndigital.com. Welcome back to our program. Congressman Brian Baird of Washington State is with us. Congressman Brian Baird, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
Brian, you tipped off Business Week to a story which is not yet even in Business Week. It's on their online edition, but I guess it'll be printed next week, about a troubling, troubling is hardly a strong enough word, a troubling practice that's happening in Congress right now.
Indeed, Tom. You know, it is actually grew out of an article in one of the Capitol Hill publications, but no one seemed to be concerned about it except me. And what the problem is very simple, and people will understand it immediately. There is currently no clear-cut ethical or legal prohibition against members of Congress or their staff using confidential information that we gain in service of our duties to make investment decisions that could make us potentially millions of dollars in ways that the general public is not able to. And I think that's wrong. Members and their staff shouldn't be able to. Neither should lobbyists who are privy to confidential information.
Yeah, this is mind-boggling. Here's how Business Week leads the story with this thing. Day traders were confused, right? And folks who are, you know, on their computers or professional day traders, they're confused. On Tuesday, November 15th, they couldn't figure out why there was so much action in USG Corporation, a Chicago-based company whose subsidiary was mired in asbestos lawsuits. Why would this company be, all of a sudden, the stock was trading at double the normal daily volume, and that day gained $2.12 to close at $61.55. But there was nothing in the news that would power a run-up. People were confused. So the Business Week says, public news, that is, there was nothing in the public news. Behind the scenes, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist had decided to override the qualms of budget committee leaders and press ahead with a bill to create a $140 billion fund to relieve companies such as USG of their asbestos liabilities. Now, as Bill Frist decides he's gonna bail this company out, and somebody in apparently Bill Frist's office is passing this information to somebody in Wall Street who's buying millions of shares in this company, knowing that it's going to go up, and there's nothing illegal about that.
That's the problem, is that you've got specialists who specialize in this, who have built contacts with staff members and maybe members of Congress themselves, tip them off the information that the public's not privy to, things about what will be in the bill or what won't be in a bill, that could literally have billions of dollars in consequences. They then share that information with traders who buy or sell stock or futures based on information that the public does not have before the public could possibly have it, possibly making millions of dollars. And they do this, the way you build the relationships that allow you to do it are through campaign contributions and other favors you provide. And, you know, the average guy who's trying to make an investment decision has no such access. He could buy stock on the very day that somebody else is selling huge quantities, because the person doing the selling has inside information.
So let me just get this absolutely straight. We're talking with Congressman Brian Barrett of Washington State, and Congressman Barrett, a Democrat from Washington, is trying to push forward some sort of action to stop this in Congress, by the way, I should add.
Yeah, right. I don't favor this.
Yeah, right. If I was a contributor to you and to you and your campaign, and I'm not, but you know, if I was, let's say I sent you a check for a couple thousand bucks every month so that you knew who I was. You would take my calls, although, again, I don't mean to portray you as a corrupt politician, but I mean,
no,
that's how it works.
Model, sure.
This is how it works in Washington, D.C. And so a big contributor, big donor, calls up and says, hey, what's going on this week? And you said to me, we're about to, tomorrow, in an hour, we're going to report out a piece of legislation to bail out the asbestos industry. And so I pick up the phone and I call up my stockbroker and say, you know, buy me a whole bunch of asbestos industry stock. They're going up, you know, or tobacco industry, uh-huh. Whatever it may be. There's nothing illegal about that, but if Martha Stewart gets a phone call from a guy who owns a company which she owns stock and says, you know, we're going to have a bad month, and she sells her stock based on that, she can go to prison.
Exactly.
What's wrong with this picture?
The distinction in the law right now, which I think we need to change, is that if you're inside a company and you have information that you gained from inside the company itself, you can't make investment decisions. But congressmen, sort of by definition, are not inside the company, and so if we provide information to a lobbyist or an investor, they can make trades on that basis with no legal or ethical restrictions right now. I just think it's wrong. I think members of Congress and their staff should not be taking advantage of their public position and the private information we get in that public position to make personal gains. Neither should lobbyists or others who gain access to such confidential information be allowed to profit. We need full disclosure. We need restrictions on congressmen and their staff making trades based on confidential information. And we need to somehow ensure that information is made available to the public at a simultaneous moment rather than to certain insiders who take advantage of that.
Now, Congressman Brian Barrett, I'm assuming that this is something. It's interesting. In the last hour, I was talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders, a colleague of yours,
right,
and somebody you know. And off the air, I mentioned to him that I was going to be talking to you about this, and he didn't even know this was going on. He was like, "You're kidding! People are doing that?"
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Yeah, apparently it's, you know." And I said, "It's incredible." And he said, "You can't even use the word incredible in Washington D.C. anymore." He said, "What's going on here is beyond believable. I mean, it's."
Tom, let me make it even more incredible, if I can. I think most Americans would say there's something fundamentally wrong with the situation as it is, what we've just described. They'll be even more alarmed. The companies that do this call themselves political intelligence, so they provide political intelligence.
There's actually an industry to do this.
There's a whole industry. It's a multi-million-dollar industry. But, interestingly enough, one of these firms that provides political intelligence was recently purchased. Guess who it was purchased by? China, a Chinese company, Xinhua Finance, which they purchased this political intel firm right about the time the CNOOC takeover of Unocal was proposed.
You're kidding. At
the time
China was negotiating to take over a U.S. oil company, the Chinese are buying a political intelligence company that's, oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
So now you have not only the integrity of our own domestic financial system intrinsically in question, you now run some very interesting foreign policy and national security issues, because you've got firms on Capitol Hill providing U.S. inside government information to companies owned by foreign powers.
Now, apparently, Congressman Brian Baird, this has been legal for decades, for maybe centuries, but it's only apparently recently that members of Congress have figured out that they can do this kind of stuff and become rich on it, or help their buddies become rich on it. And is this something that is endemic within the Republican Party, or are the Democrats doing this?
Well,
is
here's
this,
the thing, Tom,
you know, what's the deal?
You know, I'm not even sure it's a recent phenomenon. What struck me, it was kind of shocking. I learned about this spring. And I
well,
was
how long have you been in Congress?
I've been in Congress 7 years.
Yeah, and Bernie's been in Congress for, I think, you know, 15 years, something like that,
yeah.
For a long. And you guys didn't know this was going on.
It would never occur to me. I mean, in fact, it occurs to me to be so scrupulous the other way. If I hear public information in a hearing that I think that clearly anybody could have access to, it's on the web, it's in the congressional record, but I say, look, I wouldn't have gotten that if I weren't in Congress. I'm not going to make an investment decision on that. So I'm very scrupulous the other way. What shocked me was when I read this article about people taking confidential information from inside offices in Congress that they were shared with, then using that to make investment decisions. I was shocked nobody else batted an eye. But we're going to try to change it. We're going to try to put forward some restrictions that say you can't profit based on your position in Congress through investment decisions. You have to report when you make purchases or sale of stock. I'd frankly like to see us all be required to either invest in broad mutual funds or in blind trust.
Yeah. We have Annie in Olympia, Washington, has a question for you, Congressman Baird.
Annie,
if,
good morning
to you. Mind. Good morning, Annie. You're live and on the air.
Hi there. And actually, while I'm not in Brian Baird's district, I'm right next to it because I'm calling from Olympia, and he represents parts of Olympia.
Great. We have a little less than a minute left, Annie. I'm sorry.
I beg your pardon?
But we have a little less than a minute left, so we have to make it quick.
Oh, very quickly. When Brian Baird spoke about asbestos relief, the name Halliburton had to jump into my mind. So my question is, and I realize this is a slight detour, so are the Halliburton asbestos claims going to be wrapped up in this protection?
I don't know the answer, Annie. The question you raise, there are sort of so many ways to help companies by direct appropriations, by passing or limiting laws. So you've got a twofer here. You could pass legislation impacting a company's benefit, but if somebody finds out about that legislation, they can then make investment decisions based on it. So you can really do a twofer.
So members of Congress can make out like bandits and their buddies.
Yeah, exactly.
Bottom line.
That's the bottom line.
And you're going to bring this before the House Ethics Committee?
We've already sent a letter to House Ethics, and we intend to introduce legislation and hopefully a rules change to Congress to explicitly prohibit it.
We being you, Congressman Brian Baird?
Myself, and we will be gaining, hopefully, allies from both sides of the aisle who respect the integrity of Congress.
Great. It'll be fascinating to see who signs on for this and who says gulp. Fascinating. Congressman Brian Baird, is there a website, your website, people can get more information?
You bet. The easiest way is to do an MSN or Google search and hit Brian Baird.
On Brian Baird. B-A-I-R-D.
Yep.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's a warm tonight and the moon turns the tide. When the stars take their ride, she'll be leaving. Where she goes, I don't know.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news, where talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. And occasionally they come from the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Victoria Jones is with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well, it's an action-packed day in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Before
we get into that, I'm getting emails from people and notes from people, you know, saying that they're praying for Ellen's success in her surgery and how is she doing and that kind of thing. So, how is Ellen?
That's wonderful. Well, the last time I spoke to her friend, she was still in surgery. It's about a 3-hour procedure, but by now she should be out in recovery. But I haven't heard anything yet. But the last I'd heard was everything was going well.
Okay, great. So back to Washington. Thank you. Back to Washington, D.C.
Well, I mean, just very briefly, Scott McClellan answering questions. Actually, that's not true. Scott McClellan not answering questions today about the New York Times story.
Yes. Well, did you see the Drudge thing now? Drudge is breaking the story that the reporter who broke the story in the New York Times has a book coming out about this topic, as if to say, you know, the only reason anybody's bringing this thing up is because this guy wants to sell his book.
Well, CNN has now spoken to their sources, and they are confirming the story, not only confirming it, but confirming that the kind of frequency that the story references with which the NSA is routinely spying on people is, in fact, what they're hearing is the case.
Yeah, now the thing that I thought that was most interesting about this is Kate Martin, the director of the Center for National Security Studies, said the secret order, George Bush's secret order, you know, to the NSA, the secret order may amount to the president authorizing criminal activity. And this is from the Progress Report, the Center for American Progress today. Some officials at the NSA agree. According to the New York Times, some agency officials wanted nothing to do with the program, apparently fearful of participating in an illegal operation. Others were worried the program might come under scrutiny by congressional or criminal investigators if Senator John Kerry was elected president.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, that is a possibility. The NSA has been known as no such agency, so who knows whether they hang out their employees to dry. Scott McClellan was basically saying today that they were in touch with members of Congress. I don't think he responded directly to a question about congressional oversight, but Senator Arlen Specter has already said that he intends to have hearings on this matter in January.
That's interesting. Arlen Specter, the Republican. Of course, Arlen Specter, the Republican, fighting for his political life.
Exactly. And then, of course, meantime, I'm sure you know the debate on the Patriot Act, which went through the House yesterday, and who knows if it would have done today. They have been unable to cut off debate on that. Senator Frist wanted to do that and have an up or down vote. They weren't able to cut off debate. 52-47, they voted against that. They continue debating. Senator Frist apparently might try and get another vote later today, but I'm not sure that it's going to do him any good.
Yeah. And is this going to become serial humiliation for Bill Frist and the Republicans?
Well, it could well, because as it stands, the Patriot Act will expire.
Yeah. But they still, I mean, there's still time for this 90-day, you know, let's extend the thing for 90 days while we talk about it, Bill, isn't it?
That's right. There is time for that, and I suspect that they may well do that.
Is there still a lot of buzz in Washington, D.C. Going around about George Bush saying that Tom DeLay is innocent, basically jury tampering?
Not really. I mean, there has been criticism of that, and he hasn't taken it back, of course, and of course we know that Dick Cheney went to a fundraiser for Tom DeLay just, I think it was last week or the week before. No, I think there would have been more talk about it if it hadn't all been eclipsed by the New York Times story.
Yeah. I mean, you recall how George Herbert Walker Bush attacked John Walker Lynn, the American, you know, the American Taliban guy, before his trial. He was pretty soundly...
It is quite extraordinary. And, of course, as far as juries go, we know that Tom DeLay's attorney is, I believe, trying to speak to the members of the grand jury who indicted him because he suspects Ronnie Earle, the prosecutor, apparently, of jury tampering.
Oh, my. Yeah, well, of course, I mean, they're going to pull everything out of the hat
yeah.
that they can. Now,
yeah.
Also in the House of Representatives, we have one contingent of Republicans who are saying, let's make illegal aliens, people in the United States illegally, criminals under the criminal court system. Right now, and I didn't realize this, frankly, until just very recently, right now they're only criminals under the civil court system, as it were. And in other words, it's against the law, but it's not something you can go to jail for, sneaking into the United States. You can be deported for it. They're saying, let's make this actually a crime with a one-year in prison penalty or deportation. And on the other hand, you've got a group of Republicans in the House of Representatives saying, wait a minute, the big corporations that are paying our paychecks here or our, you know, campaign donors, they need these people to work for cheap for them, and we've got to give these people guest worker passes. What's happening? Is the Republican Party coming unraveled?
They are definitely having difficulties. I don't know. They're very organized. They may be able to pull it together, but I don't think that they will on this. The views are too divergent.
Yeah. I mean, you've got folks like Tom Tancredo on one side and George Bush on the other. I mean, frankly, it's...
I mean, the idea of filling the prisons with people for a year and the taxpayers paying for them, I think is going to be something that will not be popular.
Yeah, although, you know, if deportation is the option, then basically what they've done is they've criminalized something and they've just given a little more incentive to deport people and not have to pay for it. I mean,
that's
right.
Good point.
They don't have to put them in jail.
Good point.
But putting some teeth into the laws. I'm still trying to figure this thing out. I'm very ambivalent about it. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, great talking with you today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It is 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Honey, you do right to me, baby. I do right to you, too. Got to do under the... I can have them. Let me have them. Do under you.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Telling the truth to multinational corporations. Really ready. I didn't know. Good old King James I, the one who commissioned the translation of the Bible into English, declared himself the King of England, Scotland, Ireland, France, and Polaroon. Polaroon? Well, this was all about the beginning of the British Empire, and the beginning of the British Empire, in large part, was tied into the East India Company. At that time, the Dutch had their trading companies. They had tied up much of it. And the East India Company, and where the reason I'm going into this, by the way, today is the anniversary. In 1773, of the Boston Tea Party. And I just have to tell you the story of the Boston Tea Party. It's just such an amazing story, and most people don't know it. I first discovered this, I was reading Thomas Jefferson's letters and his personal diaries. And in early 1773, he had published a tract called something like A Summary View of the Rights of British Americans, which was basically about how to be a good American citizen, or how to be a good British citizen living in North America. By the end of 1773, 6 months later, a year later, he had completely changed his mind, and he was drafting what was essentially the first draft, the Virginia Bill of Rights, which was in parts of which became the Declaration of Independence. And so, you know, what had happened here? Well, it was the Boston Tea Party, and the story that I remember learning when I was a kid in school, or that I thought I remembered learning, was that in 1773, the British government passed the Tea Act. And the Tea Act was a tax on tea. And it had raised the taxes on tea in the United States. And so the good citizens of America, hating taxes, rose up, threw the tea in the harbor, said, enough of that, that's it, we're out of here. And thus began the Revolutionary War and started the United States of America. Well, it's not quite the way it happened. Turns out, there were some tax acts. There were the Townshend Acts of 1767 and the Stamp Act as well, as I recall, of 1772. But the Tea Act of 1773 was actually a reduction on taxes in the United States. One purpose of the Tea Act was to increase the profitability of the East India Company. It was basically a giant tax break for one big multinational corporation, a corporation whose stock was owned in large part by members of the House of Lords and the King. Well, actually, yeah, and the King. At that time, it was King George II, or King George III, I guess, by 1773. And because the company no longer had to pay high taxes and pretty much held a monopoly on the tea, the legal monopoly, although it wasn't a real monopoly, This was going to let them undercut the prices of local importers, the mom-and-pop merchants in the United States, wipe out of business. They were going to pull a Walmart. The Tea Act of 1773, a tax cut. This so infuriated the colonists that they started the cry, no taxation without representation. I mean, here's the official British version of the history. This is from the Encyclopedia Britannica, right? The 1773 Tea Act was a legislative maneuver by the British Ministry of Lord North to make English tea marketable in America with the goal of helping the East India Company quickly sell 17 million pounds of tea stored in England. End quote. I mean, this is what it was all about. It was on and on it went. So I started looking around for a story, for a book on the Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party. I couldn't find anything. I mean, there were children's books out, but I couldn't find a good book on the Tea Party. And because I was writing this book, Unequal Protection, and I wanted to include a chapter about it in there. And I ended up in my searches finding a book published in 1834 in New York by S.S. Bliss, a publisher in New York that's now long gone, titled Retrospect of the Boston Tea Party with a Memoir by George R.T. Hughes, a survivor of the little band of patriots who drowned the tea in Boston Harbor in 1773. And that was the title. And the reason why there's no good story of the Boston Tea Party is because the 150 more or less guys who participated in it all swore secrecy for 50 years on this thing. They said, that's it. You know, we will not, because they were committing a crime. It was a million-dollar act of vandalism. So here's this guy, George R.T. Hughes. And he is, as far as I can tell, the only, he published this one 61 years later. Most of the participants were dead. And as I was turning the brittled, age-colored pages of this book, you know, it was typeset by hand, printed on uneven-sized pages from almost 200 years ago, reading the actual story of what actually happened at the Boston Tea Party by an actual guy who was actually there. And Hughes, he starts out. I'll just share. This is incredible. I mean, this is from a guy who is actually the only account that exists of the actual Boston Tea Party. He said many American colonists either boycotted the purchase of tea or were smuggling or purchasing smuggled tea to avoid supporting the East India Company's profits. And therefore, in 1773, it rendered the smuggling of tea an object and was frequently practiced, and their resolutions against using it, although observed by many with little fidelity, had greatly diminished the importation into the colonies of this commodity. In other words, not many people were buying tea from the East India Company. Meanwhile, quoting from Hughes, an immense quantity of this tea was accumulated in the warehouses of the East India Company in England. The company petitioned the king to suppress the duty of 3 pence per pound upon its introduction into America. That was the tariff. The company said, eliminate the tax. That was the Tea Act of 1773. Then Hughes says, the East India Company, however, received permission to transport tea free of all duty from Great Britain to America, allowing it to wipe out its small competitors and take over the tea business in all of America. Hence, it was no longer the small vessels of private merchants who went to vend tea for their own account in the ports of the colonies, but on the contrary, ships of an enormous burthen that transported immense quantities of this commodity, which by the aid of the public authority might, as they supposed, easily be landed and amassed into suitable magazines. Magazines, the word they used to use for warehouses. Accordingly, the company sent its agents in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia 600 chests of tea and a proportionate number to Charleston and other maritime cities of the American colonies, or continent. The colonies were now arrived at the decisive moment when they must cast the die and determine their course. There was a meeting that was held, Hughes talks about. He talks about how in England people were trying to whip this stuff up. But anyhow, there was a meeting that was held. I'll get to that in just a second. There was a series of pamphlets then were published. And this was the blogs of the day. These were published and in the middle of the night, people would go out and they'd nail these things up to trees and buildings and doors and whatever all over. Here, this is one from 1773, right after the Tea Act, by a man named Rusticus, right? We still have no idea who Rusticus was. It's called The Alarm. And this is what this poster said. Are we in like manner to be given up to the disposal of the East India Company, who now have the assurance to step forth in aid of the minister to execute his plan of enslaving America? Their conduct in Asia for some years past has given simple proof how little they regard the laws of nations, the rights, liberty, or lives of men.
Keep in mind, he's talking about a corporation.
They have levied war, excited rebellions, dethroned lawful princes, and sacrificed millions for the sake of profit. The revenues of mighty kingdoms have centered in their coffers, and these not being sufficient to glut their avarice, they have, by the most unparalleled barbarities, extortions, and monopolies, stripped the miserable inhabitants of their property and reduced entire provinces to indigence and ruin. 1,500,000, it is said, perished by famine in just 1 year, not because the earth denied its fruits, but because this company and their servants engulfed all the necessaries of life and set them at so high a price that the poor could not purchase them. End of quote. May 27, 1773, Rusticus tosses in another pamphlet. Resolve, therefore, nobly resolve, and publish to the world your resolutions that no man will receive the tea, no man will let his stores or suffer the vessel that brings it to the moor of his wharf, and that if any person assists at unloading, landing, or store it, he shall ever be deemed an enemy to his country and never be employed by his fellow citizens. The alarm dated October 27, 1773. Another pamphlet. It hath now been proved to you that the East India Company obtained the monopoly of that trade by bribery and corruption, that the power thus obtained they have prostituted to extortion and other the most cruel and horrible purposes the sun ever beheld. On October 28th of November 1773, writes Hughes, the ship Dartmouth with 112 chests arrived. And the next morning after, the following notice was widely circulated. Friends, brethren, countrymen, that worst of plagues, that detested tea, has arrived in this harbor. The hour of destruction, a manly opposition to the machinations of tyranny, stares you in the face. Every friend to his country, to himself, and to posterity, is now called upon to meet in Faneuil Hall at 9 o'clock this day, at which time the bells will ring to make a united and successful resistance to this last, worst, and most destructive measure of administration. So they got together in Faneuil Hall, and they had a conversation about what they should do. And then they discovered, as they were having this conversation about what they should do to stop this multinational corporation from wiping out all the small businesses in North America and enslaving the country, they discovered that in their midst was a spy for the company, an agent of the company. And I got to tell you what Hughes had to say about him, and then what happened with the Boston Tea Party. Today, the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. I'll share that with you right after this break. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, all I'd like is the truth. Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Sharing with you the story of the Boston Tea Party as told by George Robert Twelvetree Hughes, the only person who actually participated in the Boston Tea Party who ever wrote a memoir about it. As far as we know, in fact, there's probably only a half a dozen names where we even have a good guess as that they were there. I mean, Sam Adams bragged about it, but never gave any details that he was there. And that's pretty much it. And George Hughes wrote actually an autobiography which has been out of print for 160 years. And I bought this copy in this antiquarian bookseller, and it's just mind-boggling. So they get together, and they are now in Faneuil Hall in Boston, and they're getting together, and they're trying to decide what to do. And, you know, this debate, what shall they do? And at that point, this guy by the name of Josiah Quinney, he pointed out that they were really discussing the possibility of going to war against England to stop England from enforcing the East India Company's right to run what he calls its ministerial enterprise, a ministerial enterprise, a business that is endorsed by the nation, right, that's being supported in some way by the country. So now, quoting from George Robert Twelvetree Hughes, in this conjuncture, Josiah Quinney, a man of great influence in the colony, of a vigorous and cultivated genius, and strenuously opposed to ministerial enterprises, wishing to apprise his fellow citizens of the importance of this crisis, and direct their attention to probable results which might follow, after demanding silence, said, now we're quoting Quinney, this ardor and this impetuosity which are manifested within these halls are not those that are requisite to conduct us to the object we have in view. These may cool, they may abate, they may vanish like a flittering shade. Quite other spirits, quite other efforts are essential to our salvation. Greatly will he deceive himself who shall think that with cries, with exclamations, with popular resolutions, we can hope to triumph in the conflict and vanquish our inveterate foes. Their malignity is implacable. Their thirst for vengeance is insatiable.
They have their allies, their accomplices, even in the midst of us, even in the bosom of this innocent country. And who is ignorant of the power of those who have conspired our ruin? Who knows not their artifices? Imagine not, therefore, that you can bring this controversy to a happy conclusion without the most strenuous, the most arduous, the most terrible conflict. Basically what he's saying here is, talk is cheap, you guys. And, you know, we can yell and scream all we want and print brochures all day long, but we're either going to have a war or we're not. And we've got to decide right now. He goes on to say, well, here again, that sentence. Imagine not, therefore, that you can bring this controversy to a happy conclusion without the most strenuous, the most arduous, the most terrible conflict. Consider attentively the difficulty of the enterprise and the uncertainty of the issue. Reflect and ponder, even ponder well before you embrace the measures which are to involve this country in the most perilous enterprise the world has ever witnessed. And that was the moment. Facing a multinational corporation attempting to wipe out the small tea vendors, and tea was, you know, the drug of choice, basically, of the colonists. Tea shops where people met, tea shops and bars, and polite companies where people hung out, the tea was served at every day. Whether they're going to wipe out all these small companies and replace them all with East India franchises and Walmartize this country in 1773, or whether we were going to fight back and say no to a multinational corporation and a giant military power that supported it. And so Hughes says, as the story goes on, the question was then immediately put whether the landing of tea should be opposed and carried to the affirmative unanimously. In other words, they're going to say, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to stop the tea. Roach, a local tea seller to whom the cargo had been consigned, was then requested to demand of the governor to permit to pass the castle, to return the ships to England. The latter answered haughtily. This is the guy who's supposed to receive the tea. Answered, no, for the honor of the laws and from duty toward the king, he could not grant the permit until the vessel was regularly cleared. A violent commotion immediately ensued, and it was related by one historian of that scene. This is how Hughes, you know, the people talk to themselves in the third person, that a person disguised after the manner of the Indians who was in the gallery shouted at this juncture the cry of war, and that the meeting dissolved in the twinkling of an eye, and the multitude rushed in a mass to Griffin's Wharf. Hughes now writes, it was now evening, and I immediately dressed myself in the costume of an Indian, equipped with a small hatchet, which I and my associates denominated the tomahawk, with which, and a club, after I having painted my face and hands with coal dust in the shop of a blacksmith, I repaired to Griffin's Wharf, where the ships lay that contained the tea. When I first appeared in the street after being thus disguised, I fell in with many who were dressed, equipped, and painted as I was, and we marched to our place of destination. He talks about how he got there and all that. We were immediately ordered by the respective commanders to board all the ships at the same time, which we promptly obeyed. He talks about how the captain simply asked him, don't harm my ship. He said, okay, no problem. We were ordered by our commander to open the hatches, and throw out the tea. You know, he goes on to say, in about 3 hours from the time we went on board, we had thus broken and thrown overboard every tea chest to be found on the ship, while those in the other ships were disposing the tea in the same way. We were surrounded by British armed ships, but no attempt was made to resist us. We then retired quietly to our several places of residence without having any conversation with each other or taking any measure to discover who our associates were. Nor do I recollect of our having had the knowledge of the name of a single individual concerning that affair, except that of Leonard Pitt, the commander of my division, whom I had mentioned. He goes on to say, no disorder took place during that transaction, and it was observed at that time that it was the stillest night ensued in Boston that Boston had enjoyed for many months. The Boston Tea Party. The beginning of the end of the British Empire in the United States. 342 chests of tea, 90,000 pounds. Enough for 24 million cups of tea. The equivalent of $1 million in today's currency, at the time 9,659 pounds sterling. And thus began the American Revolution. Amazing. It's time now for us to stand up and say, oh, we're not going to take it anymore either.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. We'll be right back. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Sometimes we talk about the things that we know about. Sometimes we talk about the things we don't know about. Sometimes we talk about the things we're not sure about. Sometimes it's the things you know that you know that you know. Sometimes it's the things you don't know that you know. Sometimes it's the things you don't know that you don't know. Sometimes you don't even know what you know. But anyway, time for our Everything You Know Is Wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. And thinks that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
This morning, 27 million slaves woke up to their recurring nightmare with a few questions for us. Is today the day I'll find freedom, be reunited safely with my family, no longer threatened and beaten? To all but a few, the answers will be a resounding no. That written by our guest, Kevin Bales, with FreeTheSlaves.net. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Tom.
Slavery around the world?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Slavery didn't die or even get abolished, and it's been coming back with something of a vengeance since the Second World War. And we our best estimates, which are now pretty much backed up by the United Nations, are 27 million people in slavery. And let me be clear, that's not bad jobs or bad marriages. That's real slavery, cannot walk away, under violence, paid nothing kind of slavery.
In what parts of the world do we find this slavery?
Well, I'm also sorry to tell you that it's almost every country in the world. The largest concentrations are in South Asia, Southeast Asia, North and West Africa, and so forth. But even here in the United States, an absolute minimum of about 10,000 that we can point to, and probably closer to 30,000.
Here in the city of Portland, where I'm broadcasting from, even though our program's going all over the country, Willamette Week, our local weekly kind of alternative newspaper sort of thing, which has actually won a Pulitzer Prize for their reporting, did a story a few weeks ago in which they really got inside the illegal drug business, the Hispanic illegal drug business in Portland. And they discovered that a lot of these kids who are out on the streets selling drugs are slaves, that they literally were sold into slavery in South and Central American countries, brought to the United States, essentially told that the only way they could get out of slavery was to sell enough drugs to pay off their fee to bring them up here, which is never payoffable, or in many cases simply, hey, you're a slave, you're going to do this, period. That they were not willing drug dealers. In fact, I saw a link from your website, FreeTheSlaves.net, to that article. And this is amazing that there's slaves in Portland, Oregon.
There's slaves in at least 90 cities that we're able to point to from news and police reports. And of course,
90 cities in the United States.
In the United States. And the west coast of the U.S., and Portland included, obviously, are also tend to be ports of entry for people who are victims of human trafficking. And again, trafficking is not smuggling. It's actually when you're being brought in because you're going to be enslaved to do something. It could be prostitution or drug dealing, or it could be working on a farm.
Buying and selling human beings.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
And now your organization, on the homepage of FreeTheSlaves.net, it says, you know, that you've freed 18 slaves. I'm assuming that you're buying people out of slavery?
No, absolutely not. We don't buy people out of slavery. That's a little
that
bit
just
like,
that would just feed the business, wouldn't it?
Exactly. I mean, that's like paying a burglar to get your TV back.
Right.
Slavery is a crime, and you don't stop a crime by paying the criminals to do better or to give you their loot or booty.
So how do you stop it?
The way we have to stop it is intervening at the point of enslavement. So I think the 18 kids that you're referring to that were freed from slavery about 10 days ago now were part of our ongoing projects. That's in West Africa, in which we go to the people who are holding those kids in slavery in the fishing industry, and we say, this is the law. We're staying here until you hand these kids over. We can bring the police and have you arrested if necessary, but it'd be a lot easier on you if, in fact, you hand them over and we take them and help them to get back to their parents. And then we also spend a little bit of time with you, Mr. Fisherman, explaining other ways to do your job without using slaves.
Aren't a lot of slaves kids who are sold into slavery by their families because their families are below subsistence level?
It can happen that way. I wouldn't say a lot. I wouldn't say the majority, but it can certainly happen that way in the poorest parts of the world. It's not so much even that the parents are knowledgeably selling their children into slavery. It's more the fact that they're easily fooled, so that people come along and say, you know, I do have a job I could give that son of yours or that daughter of yours. And that way, you know, they'd get food, and in fact, I could probably throw in some education. And the parents are thinking, this is a godsend. What an opportunity. But in fact, it's all lies. It's the trickery of human traffickers.
Yeah. And this is very common. What's the major way that slaves end up slaves around the world?
It's primarily in exactly the way I just described. Most people today aren't knocked over the head and dragged off into slavery. Most people today are taken into slavery because they're economically desperate. I mean, they do really end up in slavery for doing what you or I would do often in their shoes. They can't find work. Their children are hungry. Maybe they need medicine for one of their kids. And then somebody shows up and says, listen, I've got a job. All you have to do is get in the back of this truck and come off in the countryside with me. And when they're out there away from any kind of protection, and after they've been worked really hard for some time and usually half starved, then the threats of violence begin and it becomes clear that they've been enslaved.
To what extent is the economy of the United States right now dependent upon slavery around the world?
It's really not at all. There is a contribution to the U.S. economy, but it is absolutely minute. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of our overall economy. But, you know, that's actually good news.
Yeah.
We have slave-made goods coming into our homes, and it's very important that we enforce federal law to make sure that that doesn't happen. But the good news is that there are no vested economic interests trying to hold on to slavery except for the criminals who are doing it. And that should make it much easier to eradicate it completely.
But the criminals are deriving some benefit out of the slavery.
Oh,
I mean, people
gosh,
are working,
yeah.
Or they're selling drugs, or they're doing whatever they're doing. If there's no economic benefit ultimately to any nation, I mean, is for example, the slaves in Thailand or in Cambodia, Southeast Asian country, they're outside of the slaves who are in prostitution, you've got slaves who are doing labor, right?
Absolutely.
They're making things.
Oh, yes.
Those things are sold someplace.
Yes, yes.
Are they not sold in the United States?
They are sold in the United States, but the profits from those go to the people who are holding the slaves, and then they tend to enter the global economic supply chain and end up mixed in. Let me give you an example.
But I mean, that means that at some level our economy is dependent upon slavery.
Well, not dependent. As I say, the fractions are very small. Okay. There is, for example, slavery in cocoa production in West Africa to make chocolate.
Right.
The Ivory Coast makes about half the world's cocoa. Maybe 3-5% at most of the cocoa farms there are using enslaved labor. So the amount of the amount of chocolate or cocoa in chocolate that has actual slave input in it, it could be 1% at most, maybe 2% at most. But it's very difficult to cut that out because of the fact that it enters the global cocoa market. So it's not so – and they're getting the world price for it.
Right. And it's just that their costs are lower.
Yeah.
We're talking with Kevin Bales. He's with FreeTheSlaves.net. And, Kevin, you're an NGO, a non-profit, non-governmental organization. What about governmental organizations? What about the UN? What's being done out there?
Well, the UN is doing a fair bit as far as the UN can work. You know, everyone expects a lot of the UN, but they don't have enormous resources. There are two or three different parts of the United Nations, including the International Labor Organization, that have been doing some very good work. The fundamental need, however, is that we're simply not applying enough resources to solve this problem. And interestingly, it's a solvable problem. I'd say the total amount of money being spent to end 27 million people in slavery around the world, maybe $50 million a year. And that's
$2 per person per year.
Maybe $2 per person per year. Now, interestingly, in northern India, we're able to bring people out of slavery for about $30 a family. Again, not buying them out of slavery, but just paying the workers to get them out.
Hmm.
But
are these people then consigned to a life where they just have to go back into slavery?
No, absolutely not. Because in the work that we do, we are absolutely committed to make sure that anyone who comes out of slavery has then the opportunities to take up autonomous economic citizenship. That's crucial to us because we learned a very important lesson from the botched emancipation that happened in the United States in 1865 when we dumped 4 million people into the economy with no preparation, and we're still paying the price for that.
Yeah. So you're doing it in a more methodical, step-by-step, work-it-through way.
We tend not to help anyone to step in out of slavery until we know we have a way they can make a solid living and support their kids and everything.
Fascinating. Kevin Bales, freetheslaves.net, the website. Kevin, thank you for being with us and sharing this information today. Good talking with you as well. 16 minutes past the hour. Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Indeed, welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for Your Brain. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, will get you there. And just click the live chat link. It's official. The deep old machines can be hacked. It's happened in Leon County, Florida. It's being reported by the Associated Press here now. Tests on an optical scan voting machine. Now, these are not even the touchscreen machines. These are the optical scan machines. These are the ones where you fill out the ballot, the paper ballot. You darken the little circles or the little place between the bars, and then you feed it into a machine. And the machine says, thank you very much. It doesn't say anything, but, you know, functionally the machine says, thank you very much, and records your vote. And they tested these machines down in Florida, and the election supervisor, Ian Sancho, said, let's test these machines. Diebold says they can't be hacked. And so they bring in somebody from blackboxvoting.org who just kind of goes up and votes on the machine, and the losers were made winners, and there was no trace of the change. And the people are standing around going, what happened? How did this happen? How did this machine get hacked? The Miami Herald reported Thursday that Sancho scrapped Leon's Diebold machines this week for a voting system from another manufacturer. This is incredible. It's finally out there. It's finally out there. So I say, Baruch Hashem. Finally, you know, the Associated Press reporting this. For so long, this has been, it's a little story in the fringe, you know, nobody knows about it. No, I'm sorry. It's been done. By the way, Robert Novak leaving CNN for, guess what? A job with Fox News. Surprise, surprise. Robert Novak, who says that George Bush does know who that senior administration official was. Robert Novak, going to Fox News, he says, yeah, Bush does know, knew all along.
And I don't know. We're going to find out the senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Well, maybe. Depends on whether or not you believe Robert Novak or not. 1-866-440-THOM, our number, 866-440-8466. Jason in Everett, Washington, on the line. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I love your show, by the way. I've been listening to you for quite some time, and just let you know a little background. What I did, I busted ball for all of my 20s, getting a master's of science degree in engineering, and I'm finding that even people in my profession are on that downward race to the bottom. Seems like every time I pick up the paper, somebody's cutting back on matching contributions to 401k plans, and place I work at, we just lost our pension.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Plans, you know, and things like that. And what is all that work for that I did all throughout my 20s? That's what I'm beginning to wonder.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. I just wanted to let average middle class people know this is really what's going on.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. What's really going on is that the rich are getting richer and the middle class is vanishing in the United States. And the middle class in the United States is becoming the working poor.
We're losing a lot of awards for merit. It's all turning into awards for privilege class.
What do you mean?
Well, basically, a lot of hard work is leading to lower and lower wages now.
Oh, I see. If you're going to do well, it's because you were born into it, or you lucked into it, or I mean, it still is possible to make $1 million in the United States as a small businessman. But I can tell you, it's getting harder and harder because the opportunities to even start a business in America are vanishing daily.
Yeah, I have some friends running small businesses, and they say the environment's harder now than it was in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's incredible.
Well,
it's
thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Jason, for the call. Good to hear from you. I mean, this has got to be a tough one. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning.
Morning.
We use the optical scan system here in San Diego, and there's another chain in there that's very weak, and that is I can't remember the name of it now, responsibility chain. The results are stored on a card, a memory card.
Yeah, that's how they hacked these Diebold machines, is they programmed the hack.
You have no chain of responsibility for results of that for that card. In other words, who gives it to who and how it ends up at the
right.
Where it's counted is untraceable. Micah Gary filed a lawsuit to try to get the county or the city to have a chain of accountability for that card.
Mm-hmm.
They refused to pass it.
Yeah, and in fact, if you go back and you read the story of the election of 2002 in Georgia, where Max Cleland lost his seat, there were, as I recall, 74. I wrote an article about it. You can find it at TomHartmann.com. I believe that there were 74 memory cards with tens of thousands of votes that just vanished overnight. Nobody knew where they went, just in the city of Atlanta, which is the primarily Democratic area.
And we wonder what happened here, because the second time Donna was elected, we tried to elect her three times. The second time we tried to elect her, somehow it was mysterious. It seemed that the number of votes changed, that she should have been ahead, and it switched.
Yeah.
Nobody's really sure. I've heard rumors. I'm not positive. This is probably a rumor. But I'm not really confident about my vote anymore, Tom.
Yeah, I'm not either, Scott, and we need to do something about it. We need to get out there, and we need to speak out loudly and clearly and say enough. Privatizing a stand at Yellowstone is bad. Privatizing the vote is a crime. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
So that's how it is. That's what we got, if the president wants to admit it or not. You can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo and look us in the eye. Call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains. It's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
Welcome back. 25 minutes past, or before the hour. Yeah, we can't make it here anymore. 25 years of Reaganomics have just stripped this country naked, I'm telling you. They have ripped the flesh from the bones of the economy of this country. They are tearing this country apart. 25 years of trickle-down, supply-side, insane voodoo economics, tearing this country apart. And it's about time that the rest of us, that all of us in America stood up and said, enough already, enough. We want our country back. And the conservative... The conservative Republicans and the conservative Democrats, who are so-called conservatives, I'm telling you, Dwight Eisenhower is rolling over in his grave right now. Even Barry Goldwater and Everett Dirksen are rolling over in their graves. These guys call themselves conservatives. They are nothing but plutocrats. They're thieves. They are oligarchs. They want to see a nation run by a small number of very powerful and rich families with a lot, with absolute hereditary wealth. Yeah. Anyhow, the rant. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-884, excuse me, 440
8466, our telephone number. Steve in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Yeah, I'm calling because of something that I just read on Slashdot a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Slashdot told me news for nerds, stuff that matters.
You bet.
And it was about a debacle with Sony Music recently.
Yeah, putting their little spyware thing on their CDs.
It was more than spyware. It was something that actually made computers more vulnerable to viruses.
Yeah, you could argue that it was a Trojan horse.
The president of the RIAA
mm-hmm.
publicly praised Sony for doing it.
Wow.
And more recently, the president of the RIAA...
Now, on the other hand, though, Sony has backed away from this.
Granted, but still... then,
although I understand that the fix was worse than the original problem in some ways.
Yes. Ironically, the fix from Microsoft ended up doing a better job of fixing it than Sony's fix.
Yeah.
And that's ironic because I'm no fan of Microsoft.
Yeah.
But the other thing that happened recently was the president of the RIAA has stated they are suing websites that archive song lyrics. And they said that they want to jail the owners of song lyric database websites.
Yeah, it's amazing. Being an illegal alien in this country is not a jailable offense. Putting song lyrics on a website is.
Yes, and
now being an illegal immigrant in this country helps big corporations get richer, and drives down wages. Putting song lyrics on a website doesn't help the big corporation.
And so my question becomes: what can we do to protect the First Amendment from, of all things, copyright law?
Yeah. Well, that's a tough one, Steve. I mean, you've really opened a huge can of worms there. I, speaking as somebody who makes a certain part of my living by virtue of copyright law, I have to say I think that it is important that artists, whether it's people like me who as an author, I've 16 books now in print, or a songwriter or a poet or a painter or whatever, that if they're going to spend their creative efforts in some cases years of their lives creating a work with the hope that there can be some income from that work, that income is not simply taken from them on the one hand.
However,
on the other hand, there does seem to be, in my mind, some reasonable point in time where you say, okay, that's the end of that. I mean, Thomas Jefferson argued strongly against there being copyright laws. He didn't think that there should be copyright laws or patent laws, for that matter, in the United States. Hamilton obviously took the opposite position. Jefferson lost that argument, and probably to the benefit of American industry over time.
Yeah.
But there has to be a reasonable middle ground, Steve. I think.
True.
I do think that it is wrong.
The only thing, though, that is kind of hidden is that a lot of these record labels were actually. A lot of the music artists that the record labels claim to be trying to protect have yet to receive a check from the RIAA that says that the artist doesn't owe them money.
So oh,
money
you know,
from us and from the artist.
Yeah, you know, I could tell you publisher horror stories all day long in the publishing industry, and it's not that different in the music industry. In fact, the music industry is probably worse.
Much worse.
But nonetheless, if you're the guy who wrote the song, and that song has some value, and if somebody wants to record that song or somebody wants to use that song, in theory they should have to pay you for that song, then you don't want that song to appear on my website.
True.
Do you? And so, you know, I think that my point earlier about, you know, what is a civil crime and what is a criminal crime, I think is the important distinction here. It seems to me that you know, something like putting, you know, I think the vast majority of people who have a website, if they're putting, you know, Bob Dylan song lyrics on there, or, you know, one of my books, for that matter, and I could send them a letter saying, you know, stop doing this, or I will be able to sue you to recover the value of that book, you know, what I could have gotten from a publisher, you know, if they had sold it or something like that. That's enough to stop, I think, probably everybody. I really don't think that I need to be able to say, and I'll put you in jail.
And the other thing that happened was that the RIAA has actually started suing people for recommending artists to their friends. They're actually trying to sue people for word-of-mouth advertising.
Okay. I'm going to have to learn more about this, Steve. Steve, do you have any links on this stuff? You can send me some information?
Sure. I will on the chat room in a second.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. I look forward to it.
Yep. Bye.
Great. Thanks. Good to hear from you, Steve. Don in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Hey, Don. Welcome to the program.
Hey, you know, it's very strange. He stole my thunder because that's exactly what I was calling about, the Sony
the whole Sony BMG thing, but I guess since he stole my thunder, I have another thing I want to talk about.
Okay. All right. Well, what was your point on it? Were you concerned that Sony put that on those CDs, or that they had the right to, or that they had the need to, or, you know, I mean, what?
Well, I'm against copyright laws in the first place, because if you look back, 16th, 17th, 18th century, the intricacies of the music back then, just the whole emotion, and they didn't have the so-called protections. But now we got, you know, this corporate Britney Spears world where everything's just spit out, like, left and right.
Well, but if you look back at the 16th century, for example, if you look at 16th and 17th century when, you know, Beethoven and Mozart and Bach were composing music, basically the only people who could make a living as artists were those who were making a living as an artist either by being paid by a church or by being paid by wealthy patrons. They were basically wards of charity in a way. I mean, you had the king, or you had the local lord or the local baron commissioning a music for a wedding or something like that, or for a funeral of somebody, and they were paid for it.
Well, I mean, I like to dabble in composition myself, and it's in your blood. People will not stop making music.
I don't disagree with you at all. However, if you decide not to do whatever it is that you do right now for a living and instead want to make music for a living, shouldn't you have the right to do that and have some protection for that?
Well, I don't know. I guess I'll just have to disagree with you on that. But the reason I'm calling, I was thinking as far as the whole problem with the wages,
mm-hmm.
And paying workers overseas, like 40 cents an hour or whatever it is they pay in
right.
China.
Yeah.
Why not enact some kind of legislation to, since the Constitution applies to everyone, foreign and domestic, as far as I understand. I
mean, on U.S. soil.
What's that?
On U.S. soil.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Our Constitution does not say these are the laws for U.S. citizens. It says persons. And so whether a person is an alien, even an illegal alien, has constitutional rights under the Constitution, I believe. And but somebody in China doesn't have rights under the U.S. Constitution.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I was thinking maybe there'd be some kind of argument to be made that since it's a U.S. company or selling in the U.S., that they would have to pay an American minimum wage. That might solve the whole problem.
Well, the two problems with that, that's a variation, Don, on what some of the unions are proposing, which is that, you know, they want to have trade agreements or labor, you know, yeah, trade agreements that have labor protections in them, and so that the Chinese, for example, can form labor unions other than the one big official labor union, which is the only state-sanctioned one, and see their pay go from 40 cents an hour up to, say, a buck an hour. And at a buck an hour in China, in many parts of China, you can actually live a decent middle-class life, you know, put your kids through school, you know, own your own home, have transportation, the whole thing, just because there are different, it's a different economy. And the problem with that is it's still a dollar an hour, you know, U.S. And so I think that the simple way to do it is to go back to the way that we did it in this country from 1787 until Ronald Reagan started deconstructing these things and Bill Clinton really took them apart. And that's tariffs. That's where you say if it costs, if a pair of tennis shoes made in the United States, there's a dollar's worth of labor, and you can make those shoes in China with 10 cents worth of labor. That's fine. You can do that. But when you bring them into the United States, as soon as they cross the border, there's going to be a tax of 90 cents on those shoes called an import tariff. And that way it's going to cost you a dollar for the labor functionally no matter where you make them. And in fact, you go back in history and look, I mean, before World War I, you know, in 1910, 1911, I forget which year it was, 40%, 40 or 45% of the entire income of the federal government was from import tariffs. I mean, 100% of the federal budget was from import tariffs leading up to the Civil War. So, you know, not only did we protect our industries, but we actually had an income source from doing that. And it's tried and true. It works. Don, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. It's just, rather than trying to control the wages of another country, we just, you know, say, hey, you know, it's our border. That's where our control begins. 45 minutes past there.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, we'll send you glad tidings from New York. Open up your eyes so you may see.
Oh, you tell him, Van.
Ask him not to read between the lines. Hope that you will come right in on time.
And welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people. It's the end of the week. I just want to say a special thanks to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark and Dan Jacobs at Air America, who I understand from the folks who work with Rachel Maddow are just terribly cute guys. To Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thanks a lot. Thanks for a great week. Hope you have a wonderful weekend and all that sort of thing. Anyhow, back to the radio program. Well, I guess that's part of the radio program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Jack in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Good day to you, Tom Hartman.
Well, good day to you, Jack.
Hey, Tom, I just, you know, offer many kudos to you for the stand-up job that you do in exposing the evil abroad here in the world.
Well, thank you. Somebody's got to do it.
Well, you're sure doing it. Nobody's doing it better than you, man. I can guarantee you that.
Thank you.
And I listen to a lot of different shows. And, Tom, you mentioned a few minutes ago that there's a part of the hidden agenda, I think, basically was what you were saying, that there's an oligarchy in control of that hidden agenda and that they're seeking to establish themselves above us all.
We're back to the days of the British Empire and the British East India Company, Jack. People think this is something brand new. No, this is something very old. We are going back to feudalism. We are going back to the merger. In modern days, Mussolini thought he invented something new in the 1920s when he said, let's merge corporate interests and state interests because that way you'll have economic power and political power, and together you'll have a state that won't fall easily, you know, that will have stability.
Yeah,
but really all he was doing was reinventing feudalism.
And that's a classic definition of fascism, what you just said.
That's right. That's, in fact, Mussolini invented the word.
Yeah.
It came from the Latin word fasce, which was the bundle of sticks with an axe sticking out of the top of it with a rope around it, which, by the way, you will find carved into the speaker's podium on the United States Senate.
Absolutely.
The fasce, which was the symbol of the Roman Empire.
Yes, and also it was on the back of the Mercury dime, which preceded the Roosevelt dime in this country.
Right.
It was right on the back of the money, just as the Illuminati pyramid is on the back of the $1 bill. And it's actually the front of the Great Seal of the United States, which is two-sided, which usually escapes, it's designed to escape many people.
Yeah, although lest we get too far into conspiracy theory with this, Jack.
Well,
the
when you
reason...
see it right on the money, Tom, it's really not a theory anymore.
Well, you know, yeah, and I'll go pretty far out there with you on the Masonic symbols, for example, on our money. The reason why the fasce is in the Senate and was on our money, it has nothing to do with Mussolini and fascism, though. It has to do with the Roman Empire. It has to do with the fact that the Roman Empire was the first republic and the first major republic in some ways, at least in its early days. And some of the founders thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, they basically borrowed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Tom, I think it's a global agenda also. That was the main point I wanted to make. This is not, the things are given their momentum here in the United States in various ways, on a technological level, on a geopolitical level, on a war footing level. And we have been the enemy of the world in real time and real motive and agenda and effect. In particular, these last 3 years or so that we've been in Iraq. And we could turn the enmity of the world around because it's not nearly as strong against us as our very own leaders who subscribe to that secret agenda that we mentioned in the first part about they're setting themselves up. And I think if you look into the UN, and you may be aware of this, into their bylaws or basically what they have proposed within their own organization, but it's on paper and it can be seen, it has been seen by people who have reported it. They plan on bringing the population of this planet down to a half billion, which is about a 90% decrease in the number of people on the planet. So
Jack, I can't go quite that far with you. But what I can tell you is, and I remember back, 30 years ago, longer than that, almost 40 years ago. In fact, it was more than 40 years ago, reading None Dare Call It Treason by John Stormer and getting into the whole, the UN is out to get us theory.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, you want an agency that's really out to get us. It's not the United Nations. It's the World Trade Organization.
Yeah,
that,
I can believe that.
Because the United Nations, at least sovereign nations, have votes. Yes, it's not the most fair thing and all that sort of thing. I'll give you all that. World Trade Organization is run of, by, and for multinational corporations.
Yes, as Emil Rothschild said, if you control the money, and he founded the bank, if you control the money, you control the people.
Yeah,
and that's what fascism is all about. But
there you go. There you go. Jack, well said and good point. I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. Larry in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Guten Tag, Herr Hartmann.
Mir geht es gut, Larry. Und Ihnen?
Very well, thank you. I sent you off last week to Germany with the breaking news about the air marshal shooting the passenger in Miami. Sorry about that, but as I watched the story progress through the day, we saw justifications for the shooting as he said he had a bomb, but then passengers around him later on said he didn't have a bomb, and we saw threatening gestures, yet he seemed to be a mentally ill man that his wife said needed his pills. And
yeah, it could have been just a guy having a panic attack and running off the plane.
Exactly, and he was shot in the jetway, not on the plane. Why would he be running off the plane if he's a suicide bomber?
Yeah.
Why was he shot in the body, not in the head, trying to incapacitate the man immediately? So you
pose a lot of questions, Larry. What do you think the answer is? We've got just a few
seconds.
I don't
know, but they're putting these Viper teams on public transportation systems. Tom, I ride a ferry every day. Am I going to have to worry about replaying
being shot?
That half a back of the Seahawks throwing a bomb and making some kind of motion, and then have one of these non-trained air marshals that are suddenly on the ferry.
Larry, let's hope that you don't have to worry about that. Let's absolutely hope that you don't have to worry about that. But I think that we are being acclimatized or acclimated or inured to, or whatever the proper phrase is. We are getting used to such incredible police presence in this country. And frankly, I don't think it's a healthy thing for the United States. Thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information.